you know, everything this guy brings you is above average, is way above the charts in terms of, like, poise, demeanor, rising to the occasion, not getting emotional, like being able to pitch in big games. Like, he can answer to every one of those questions.
Welcome back. It's the Big Show in the Morning. We're in hour number two. My name is Matt Rose. Nick Alberga joins me. Thanks for taking some time. Alex Brody, our producer today. We got a jam-packed hour number two. As we go down the Alice Pizza and Sports Bar guest hotline to kick things off, talk a little bit of hockey, talk a little bit of Ottawa Senators. Ian Mendez from The Athletic joins us this morning. Good morning, Ian. How's it going?
Hey, fantastic, guys. How are you?
We're doing so far so good. Listen, there's a lot to talk about with this Senators team, and we've chatted already throughout the course of the offseason, but the most recent news coming out, a big, shiny contract extension for Tim Stützle. Were you surprised at all with him getting this extension done as he's about to enter the final year of his ELC?
Yeah, I mean, I was. And just to paint the picture for your listeners, the Senators had this big season launch event for the media yesterday. And, you know, they invite the media to come in and get a preview of, they're kind of giving you an update on, like, where season tickets are at, and here's going to be some of the new things in the arena this year, and here's a chance to meet Alex DeBrincat for the first time in person. And we're wrapping everything up, and all of a sudden they're like, hey, just a heads up, we got one more thing. Everyone stick around. We're like, oh, okay, what's this going to be? Maybe Claude Giroux is going to come out or something. And all of a sudden, Pierre Dorion and Tim Stützle get up on front of the stage, and you're like, what's going on here? And Pierre Dorion says to Tim, how do you feel about staying for another 8 years? And it was just like, whoa, that kind of came out of left field. But the way it was explained to us is, look, they'd been negotiating for the last few weeks, and things obviously accelerated in the last few days, and they got this deal done. And this is kind of atypical for Ottawa. They're not the team that signs these sort of players a year out of their ELC expiring. Usually it goes to the wire. We saw Brady Tkachuk actually miss regular season games. Josh Norris kind of played out his entry-level deal. So this was a real surprise, but I think for Ottawa fans, they're feeling pretty excited today.
Ian, you've covered this team for a long time. There's been ups, there's been downs. Can you remember an offseason like this one?
No, I can't. And I think, and it's great that you mentioned the ups and the downs, right? Because I think there's been some tremendous highs with this franchise in the last, 10 or 15 years, right? They've been to the Stanley Cup final, albeit 15 years ago, but they've had some deep playoff runs and fun runs, like, Andrew Hammond and the Hamburglar run and things. Hmm. They've had some magic carpet rides, we'll say. But at the same time, they've had the exact opposite, which is controversy and, kind of tumultuous exits of star players and, issues with the finances and all this stuff. And to think that it's turned around like this, like I would be, I'm hard pressed to think of a team in the NHL that's done a 180 like this in such a short span. And a great example of this is Pierre Dorion. You got to remember, Pierre Dorion's reputation in this market was probably where Jim Benning's reputation was in Vancouver a couple of years ago, where you're thinking there's nothing that this guy can do to salvage his reputation. Like that horse has left the barn. A lot of us thought there's no way he could come back from where he is, having to do some unpopular things that he's done. And yet here we are in Ottawa. They're calling it the summer of Pierre, or hot Pierre summer, or whatever you want to, whatever you want to call it. And it's been a remarkable turnaround. So it's hard to remember an off season that has brought the fans so much joy, but especially when you measure it against the previous off seasons and years in which players are leaving, there's a swirl of negativity, and now it just feels like it's good vibes and positivity around here.
Now he's just got to pull off this rumored Jacob Chychrun trade, and they'll build him a statue, hey?
There you go. Like, and that's, Ottawa fans are getting greedy now. Like, they're like, well, we've got everything we want. Now, how about Jake Chychrun? So it's been fun. But yeah, that's kind of the one piece I think that's probably missing, is one more defenseman here.
You feel like there's where there's smoke, there might be fire there?
I think so. And I mean, it's funny because I think a lot of Ottawa fans are, they're looking at Calgary and they're looking at their defense situation and thinking, oh, is there too many pieces there? Or I think Ottawa fans always look, and Mackenzie Weegar, he grew up here. He's an Ottawa guy. I think a lot of people are like, oh man, Mackenzie Weegar, maybe he just plays out the 1 year in Calgary and then he's a UFA and he comes home and he's right shot D, who can play top 4 minutes. Like, you know, the one other name that people always bring up that I'm sure would be of interest to your listeners, that Mackenzie Weegar is certainly on the radar of Ottawa fans. But yeah, I think they're going to try to get a top four guy. Now, whether it's Jake Chychrun or not, I think the assets to get Chychrun are going to be, it's going to be pretty significant. I think you're looking at, you know, first round asset type pieces that you're going to have to give up. And maybe Ottawa says, you know what, maybe we'll start this season and we're going to lean a little bit more on Jake Sanderson, who's a fifth overall pick. And maybe Jake can come in and do what, you know, what Moritz Seider did in Detroit, or just kind of come in and be a legitimate top four guy. Maybe you don't have to trade for Jacob Chychrun if Jake Sanderson kind of hits his ceiling and hits the ground running. I think we got to be careful on the expectations on him. I think he's a wonderful player. Like, I think they're going to love Jake Sanderson. I want to be hesitant. I think it's a little unfair to throw a kid into a situation and say, oh, by the way, you're going to be a top four defenseman on a team that has playoff aspirations. So that would be the one caveat I have, is that, Jake Sanderson could be potentially that top four guy that they're looking for.
You just never know, but I do think there is a glaring need for defense on the back end. And I would say, you know, it's different going from the hunter to the hunted. And now when you have an offseason like this, you're the team that, you know, teams are not going to take lightly anymore. And with that, I ask you, is the pressure now firmly on DJ Smith to put out a competitive roster and to be successful?
Yeah, it is. And, you know, and DJ is the type of guy that I think even in his season-ending press conference last year, remember, this was before they got Alex DeBrincat and Claude Giroux and traded for Cam Talbot and, you know, all these things that they did. Before the season, like before all of that, DJ Smith said, look, when we come to the training camp next year, the heat has to be on me. It has to be on our coaching staff. We have to take this program to the next level. No more next year and the, you know, the future is you know, a year away. So he's ready, I think, for the, you know, sort of the pressure and the bullseye to be on him. And in his defense, you know, he hasn't had a great roster to work with the last couple of years. Like, I don't know how many coaches would be able to come in and win games with a group that they've had and the goaltending that they've received in the last couple of years. So it's a fresh start for him. I do think the pressure's on him, but I think he's aware of that. He's cognizant of it. And he knows that they have to hit the ground running. They can't. The last couple of years, they've been out of the playoff race essentially by like the 15-game mark of the season. Like, I think, you know, last season they won 4 of their first 20 games. The year before, I think they won 2 of their first 12 or 13 games. They can't do that. They can't get off to even a pedestrian start. Even if they win 5 of their first 12 or 13 games, I don't know that that's good enough. They need to be a competitive team right away. They're lucky they got a little bit of a home-heavy schedule that should theoretically help them. But yeah, this is a different phase of the quote-unquote rebuild in Ottawa. The expectations have arrived at the doorstep, and I think DJ Smith is aware of that.
And for Smith, I would argue that maybe, you know, there's a lot of stuff that you have to do as a head coach, training camp, sort your lines, sort your pairs, get all that type of stuff sorted. But I would argue that that top six is almost set already, the way that Norris and Batherson and Tkachuk played together when they were healthy. And then on top of that, you could just kind of airdrop in DeBrincat, Giroux to play with Stützle. I might be oversimplifying things, but that's kind of how I look at it from the outside.
No, and you're not oversimplifying it at all. In fact, that's exactly how they're going to start. And I think that's the type of thing that people, as you sort of, you know, as we get past Labor Day, your mind as a hockey fan starts to think about the potential pool that you might be in, right? In a couple of weeks, you're starting to think about, well, who should I draft? And, you know, it's going to be a fun situation to think who's going to get the power play minutes in Ottawa, because they got a top six that all probably feel like they deserve first unit power play minutes, and a defenseman in Thomas Chabot who probably feels like he should be on the first unit power play. Well, there's 7 guys for 5 spots. So that's going to be an interesting thing to watch unfold. But the way you laid it out is exactly the way it's going to start. So they're going to start with Josh Norris with Brady Tkachuk and Drake Batherson. That's been a pretty successful line for them over the last year and a half. And then they're going to try Timmy Stützle in the middle with Claude Giroux on one wing and Alex DeBrincat on the other. And DeBrincat, you know, we had a chance to talk to him yesterday. And, you know, DeBrincat's a guy who is a right shot forward who likes to play his offside. Mm-hmm. And he just says, you know, I feel more comfortable coming into the zone that way. And the one thing DeBrincat told us yesterday is, you know, in just a couple of informal skates, he feels like Claude Giroux reminds him a little bit of Patrick Kane. with the vision, with the passing. And, you know, the DeBrincat, I think, was the recipient of a lot of, you know, of the creativity and dynamic play of Kane. And that's why he's been a multiple 40-goal scorer in this league. And I think you're surrounding him with Stützle and Giroud with some players who have, you know, in the case of Giroud, he's certainly been a world-class player. And in the case of Stützle, I think he's got the potential to be a world-class player. So it's going to be interesting to see if it clicks right away, but that is absolutely the way they're going to roll the top six here.
We're talking to Ian Mendez, who covers the Senators for The Athletic here on The Big Show in the morning, Sportsnet 960. My name is Matt Rose, and he's Nick Alberga.
Ian, when's the last time Ottawa was a cap team? Like, can you remember, like, is this something that's going to be a thing now for years to come? Because I just think it opens up so much for this franchise to be able to spend like other teams, specifically in their division, right?
Yeah, absolutely, right? Because you look at the Atlantic Division, and even though Ottawa's made all these improvements, there's an argument to be made, and a sound one at that, that no one's moving out of those playoff spots in the Atlantic, right? Like, let's be honest here. Tampa's not going anywhere. Toronto's not going anywhere. I mean, I know Florida's undergone some significant changes. I still think they have enough talent. Like, they won the President's Trophy. I don't think they're going anywhere. Boston is the one team that everybody looks at and says, you know, they're due for a regression, but we've been saying that for years. So until they do regress, I don't know. But these are all teams that have spent, you know, close to the cap. So Ottawa's had to get into that stratosphere. They've had to be now a team that gets out of the bottom five of spenders. And certainly, you know, coming into this season, they're going to move more into the middle of the pack. And, you know, in terms of the last time they were a cap team, boy, you got to go back to pretty much right out of, you know, right when the salary cap was created. You know, Ottawa, ironically, was the first team that really felt the salary cap crunch because they had this great collection of players with Daniel Alfredsson and Marian Hossa, Zdeno Chara, and Wade Redden and Jason Spezza and all these guys, Danny Heatley. They all had to make, you know, different things work. And, you know, Zdeno Chara was the first guy that was kind of like a cap casualty where they couldn't keep Chara and Redden. And really, you're going back 10 to 15 years since Ottawa was a team that was a cap team or close to it. I think maybe around 2010 even they were close to the cap, or they were a top five or six spending team in that 2010-2011 window. But realistically, yeah, this is a completely different feel and look for Ottawa, and they've got all of these core guys, at least the big five in the core, signed up to long-term deals.
I'm a humongous fan of Cam Talbot from his time here in Calgary. He was a very solid goaltender in Minnesota as well. Do you see him being maybe a bit of a tandem with Anton Forsberg? Maybe a little bit of a fantasy wrinkle here for our listeners as well.
Yeah.
But do you see him as a tandem with Forsberg or more of a kind of a workhorse?
Yeah, this is the classic, you know, when you're drafting your fantasy football team and you're like, damn, this team has two running backs and,
yep,
and I know I'm going to draft the wrong one. This is Ottawa. Like, I think, you know, Cam Talbot was very good last year in Minnesota from a, you know, a durability standpoint. I know some of the underlying numbers, if you start to go deeper, people are like, nah, Cam Talbot had a subpar season. But just from a very a durability perspective, I thought he was really good. I think he played around 50 games. That's Cam Talbot has told us that's his plan. Look, he's like, I'm coming in here. My plan is I want to play 50 games. Anton Forsberg is coming in, and I think his mindset is, I want to play 50 games. I don't think there's any reason for us to start sounding the alarm bell for a goalie controversy or anything like that. But I do absolutely think that we're going to come into a situation where the hot hand plays. Like DJ Smith has been submarined by poor goaltending in his three seasons in Ottawa. Like, the one thing he hasn't had, and I will defend him to the ends of the earth on this, he hasn't had consistent goaltending, like, at all. And I think it's very hard to win in this league without it. And I think he's going to, whoever's the hot hand, he's going to go with it. I don't think he's interested in, wow, we're paying this guy this amount of money, so he's the starter. Like, not really. I mean, Cam Talbot, I think, is making 3.5. Anton Forsberg's making 2.7. There's not a big discrepancy there. The hot hand will play. My guess, if I had to really make an educated guess, your opening night starter will be Anton Forsberg, only because I think he did a lot for this group last year. He basically saved their season. Like, it was going off the rails. He came in. He was dynamic. He was terrific. He added stability to a situation that was, like I said, off the rails. I think the group that was here kind of feels like he's our guy. Like, and maybe they owe him that first start. But beyond that, I don't think they owe him anything. I think it's going to be a fun, open competition to watch. And wouldn't shock me if we get to the halfway point of the season, we're like, wow, each guy has played 20 games and there's not a real big discrepancy between the two of them.
Have you heard anything on reverse retros for the Senators? Do we know what they're going to look like? I do like some of the old Sens jerseys from the early 2000s.
Listen, I just need to know, is this Blasty coming back in Calgary or what? That's my question. No, you know what? It's funny. So Ottawa is going to their 30th anniversary season this year, which is kind of mind-blowing to think that, you know, that first season in 92-93 was 30 years ago in October. They unveiled yesterday at the season launch event. There was, like, very briefly they showed this kind of 30th anniversary logo that incorporated Parliament Hill, like the Peace Tower of Parliament Hill. And I thought, oh, I wonder if that's going to be kind of part of the reverse retro. And I think the reverse retro stuff is really fun. Like, I know it's a little wacky. It's a little bit a touch of, like, the NFL color rush stuff, where if you like it, you like it. If you don't, you don't. I'm all in. I'm all for let's be a little bit creative. Let's get out of the box or whatever. So I'm thinking, I saw that yesterday. I thought, boy, wouldn't that be cool if they could incorporate the kind of Peace Tower logo into Ottawa's reverse retro. So that, I don't know, that's something that was kind of on my radar yesterday. But no, I haven't seen any definitive leaks that are like credible that lead me to believe that this is what we might see this season.
Okay, well, we'll continue to wait with bated breath. do appreciate the time today, Ian. I know it's been an exciting offseason for Ottawa, and we're very intrigued to see how things really start to play out. You know, look at the offseason for the Flames and the offseason for the Senators. I'd say between Pierre Dorion and Brad Treliving, a lot of miles and a lot of phone calls, but a lot of good work done as well, and we appreciate your time, too. Thanks very much.
Yeah, have a great day, guys.
There you go. That's Ian Mendez from The Athletic. Does a great job covering the Senators out in our nation's capital, out in Ottawa. And Timmy Stützle in the fold long term. This is going to be an interesting group for the next 5 or 6 years.
It is. And we're down to 10 NHL RFAs, by the way. Just announced Montreal re-signing Caden Primo to a three-year contract, one way each year, I believe around $890 per season. Which is fascinating because information came out last night that Montreal was in talks with Jake Allen on an extension, which, to the best of my knowledge, is not true. And if this is Kent Hughes floating information out to put heat on Caden Primo, that is some baller work right there. I'm impressed.
And they still got Sam Montembeau signed for a couple of seasons as well. Like, it makes sense. You're like, listen, just get in, short-term deal. Montembeau will be here for 2 years, then he'll probably leave unless he just, like, you know, explodes in the next couple of years. But I don't necessarily see that coming. Yeah, it's a nice little ad for the Habs there.
Yeah, I think the read here is that Primo's going to back up Jake Allen this season, expecting Price not to play, and Montembeau's going to play in the A, and if they need him at the NHL level, they can call him up. That's my read, but I was intrigued last night when I heard that Jake Allen, who's entering a contract year, potentially was in contract talks. At this point, it just doesn't make much sense. I think you go into the season with Jake Allen and you analyze from there and then you move on. So interesting stuff here. If again, I'm just speculating. If that's Kent Hughes floating it out there to get this contract signed with Primo, that's it's pretty smart work, if you ask me.
Yeah, that's, well, man, he would know it from both sides, right? He's got the agent ilk, and then all this new information he's getting in as a GM. It all makes sense. It all starts to line up. That's for sure. Uh-huh. I'm excited to watch the Senators this season. It's weird to say, but I'm excited to watch the Senators.
Yeah. No, it's just so, like, I love, you know, I have a couple buddies, actually, more than a couple, like 3 or 4 or 5 people I know that are big-time Senators fans, and they're so pumped up. But I think it's just integral to pump the brakes and to temper expectation. And maybe I'm Mr. Pessimist when it comes to Ottawa, but that back end scares the hell out of me. Thomas Chabot's their number one. I know he gets paid like a number one defenseman, but he is not very good defensively. So I know that team's going to score goals. We just talked about their goaltending. They're pretty good. Whatever, you know, you want to do with Forsberg and Talbot, I think they're going to be okay, and they're much better and much improved. But I still think they're going to struggle to keep the puck out of the net, and it's more so where they fit inside this division. I think their best bet to make the Stanley Cup playoffs could be to outduel the Boston Bruins, but the Bruins are only going to get stronger as the season goes along.
Yeah.
So I've just mentioned this time and time again, and the first month and a half is so pivotal for Boston to stay afloat. If they do, then I think, you know, it's going to be tough press, hard press for the Ottawa Senators to make it. They're in the right direction, but it just reminds me a lot of teams, younger teams that seemingly were ready to take that next step and didn't. So I'm tempering my expectations at least.
Well, I believe it was Steve Yzerman in the Red Wings who at the beginning of last year said, we just want to be playing meaningful games through March and through April. And I think that's kind of the bar that you have to set for the Senators this year. You don't want to be, you know, so far out of the race in January and February that you're playing games that don't matter. With this young core, sure, if you don't get to the playoffs, yeah, it's not great. But if you can at least have these guys in situations where they're battling for their playoff lives in April, in late March, that in itself, I think, is a huge benefit to some of these players like Tkachuk and a Norris and a Bathurst, and the list goes on, right?
Yeah, we love experience, right, in the NHL world, and teams love talking about experience. It's, like, so cliche to talk about experience. But you're right, like, these guys need those big-time games, and I'm taking nothing away from Claude Giroux brings to the table and Alex DeBrincat and another year wiser for the captain, Brady Tkachuk, and others. I just look at that division. I think it's going to be difficult, but you're right. If there's a team I'm looking forward to seeing outside of the Calgary Flames, of course, with their changes, it's probably the Ottawa Senators because, again, there's so much fascination. Can they live up to the building here?
That's the story with the Senators, and we thank Ian for joining us down the Atlas Pizza and Sports Bar guest hotline. 14-time Consumer Choice Award winner for takeout or delivery. Call 403-248-3344 or dine in at Atlas Pizza 6060 Memorial Drive Northeast, and we're going right back down the guest hotline. Tim Leeper going to join us formerly of the Toronto Blue Jays to talk a little bit about those Toronto Blue Jays. 3 of 4 wins against the Orioles off today on their way to Texas. We'll get the latest from Leeper around the corner. Sportsnet 960, The Fan. It's a big show in the morning on a Thursday, getting your day underway. Thanks for taking some time. Appreciate you joining us today. Whether you're listening live or on the podcast, Apple, Google, Spotify, or Amazon, search for The Big Show, hit subscribe, never miss a moment or an interview that we do down the Atlas Pizza and Sports Bar guest hotline. My name is Matt Rose. Nick Alberga joins me, and down the guest hotline is Tim Leeper, formerly of the Toronto Blue Jays, first base coach, bench coach, you name it, did a little bit of everything for the Jays, and we thank Tim for taking some time today. Tim, how are you?
Yeah, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. There's lots to talk about this recent series with the Toronto Blue Jays. I wanted to start with your thoughts on Alek Manoah after the loss on, it would have been Tuesday. Because he's sitting there in the dugout, he's watching the Orioles celebrate, and I think at that point a lot of Jays fans felt like they were going to get a gem the following day, and sure enough it was. So what was your takeaway from seeing Manoah just, I guess, take it all in after the loss?
I think the greatest thing was the way he went about it. And again, you're playing the Orioles. I know the Orioles are in second place, and they're kind of hot on their heels. But at the end of the day, the Blue Jays are a much better team than the Orioles. And I think to respond to all the emotion of the other day in a way that was I'm going to, lack of a better word, like childish or go down to that level, like I thought that would have been a really bad thing for this team. I think this team's better. I think they need to know they're better. I think they need to play better. And your whole day is, it depends on the starting pitcher. And the way that he went out and faced him yesterday, knowing he was better, and he went out, I think he said he wanted to just shut him down and keep him quiet early, which he said after the game, which is perfect. It's like he didn't play into the emotion. He didn't play into the hype. He knew he was a better pitcher. He knew that he was pitching for a better team, and he just went out and methodically went about his business and did it in a totally professional way, and I thought it was awesome, and I think it was the absolute right thing at the right time, and it shows a lot of – I think he just picked everybody up. It shows a lot of – The maturity on his part as a guy who's only really in his second year is amazing, but it was also like the message the team needed too.
Yeah, the guy's an absolute bulldog. I was just so impressed with, he always seems to back up sort of what he's saying or his mentality or what he's feeling. He's just an elite company. What do you think his ceiling is, you know, in the next 5, 10 years in the majors?
I mean, he's pitching like a true number one right now. And, you know, it's funny because with young guys, you worry about the injuries. And if you go back to our teams in 15 and 16, and we had Sanchi and Stroman coming up, and you, I mean, they were great as rookies and first year players, second year players, and you worry about the injury thing, and obviously like their career paths have taken a little different turns. But I think with Manoah, again, if the health is always going to be the determining factor. You know, everything this guy brings you is above average, is way above the charts in terms of like poise, demeanor, rising to the occasion, not getting emotional, like being able to pitch in big games. Like, he's answered every one of those questions. So I think his ceiling is as good as his health. If this guy stays healthy, I mean, you have a guy who's going to be a really great pitcher for a really long time.
And you got to like how the rotation kind of looks as you get ready for the postseason. If Manoah is the guy at the very top, I know they've had maybe a little bit of up and down play from Berríos lately, but you got some pretty good arms there with Stripling being your third guy. And then if you can go to Gausman as well, do you like the way that it almost lines up if you find yourself in a playoff series?
You know, I would feel better. Like just personally, I would have felt better like to attack the pitching, starting pitching market a little bit more during the trade deadline. I mean, because if you look at, like, yesterday they asked me, should it be Gausman or Manoah number one? And I think, you know, there's no bad answer to that question. But after watching Manoah last night, like, he may get ahead of Gausman. But at the same time, those are two really good guys going for you those first 2 days. Stripling's been awesome. Like, Stripling's kind of taken this rise, much like Marco Estrada did for us back in 15, where he seems to be getting it. He's done it for like 9 or 10 starts in a row. Like, it's more than a fluke right now, so it's good. So you need really good pitching, starting pitching depth to get deeper into the playoffs. And someone needs to step forward. I mean, if Berríos takes that step forward, it's big. But I think right now you're looking at, you know, Manoah and then Gausman and then Stripling and then kind of hoping you get there. So, again, I would like to see a little more depth. I think the teams that are going to be in this at the end probably are showing that depth, but it doesn't mean that they're not good enough to do it, that someone needs to really take a step forward, and as Stripling has, but you really need Berríos to keep doing well in order to, like, keep going deep and being successful deep into the playoffs.
Leaps, did you chuckle when you saw Rougned Odor playing the role of Peacemaker the other night? Like, is that guy serious?
Yes. That's the greatest question. I said, what is wrong? My initial thought was, what is wrong with this picture? Like, that's never happened against the Blue Jay team. I mean, I remember he did the same thing he did against us in Texas. He did it in Lansing a few years earlier. I think John Birdie was on the receiving end of a sucker punch. So, yeah, that was a bizarre world. I do always like that. You know, obviously I don't like Odor very much, but I do like his last great moment was probably, you know, that punch, because he didn't do very well against the playoffs. And every time he's on the other side of the field from the Jays now, I actually feel pretty good about our chances. So anyway, that was pretty funny. That's hilarious that you said that.
What do you know about Brian Baker? And I don't know if there's any background to kind of the antics. You called it childish earlier. I don't think a lot of people really understood the root of it, but it was a little strange to see it kind of play out the way that it did over the last few days.
I have no idea of the background. I do know he made his debut here last year, and obviously there's some underlying things there that were in the clubhouse that obviously nobody else really knew about, because to make Teoscar Hernández that mad, like, I've never seen that before in my life. Like, there's some real underlying issues there. I have no idea what happened, but I do know like he likes to go out there. He's emotional and he likes to run his mouth a little bit when things are going good. So obviously the guys didn't take very well to it. And I kind of like the way it was handled. I like the fact that the team went out there and they stood up for each other. But my takeaway from that one was, like, whoever, if you piss off Teoscar Hernández, like you did something pretty bad, because this guy's as solid as they get.
Guy's always smiling, right? I was going to ask you, too, in all years of baseball, not to date you too much, like, do you remember a specific brawl? Like, what's it like to run in there? I said this on the show yesterday. My dream as a baseball player growing up was to be a reliever in professional baseball and run in from the pen to join everybody in conversation at the mound. It just seems like a lot of fun, you know?
It can be. I think it depends on depends on the situations a lot. I remember I remember Sean Reed Foley making one of his first starts in Yankee Stadium, and he walked, like, the bases loaded in the first, and Judge and Stanton and some other great player was coming up, and it was one of the few times Gibby ever went out to the mound. So this could be you taking one of two ways, but everybody got around the mound, and I think Gibby said to him, he goes, "I don't know what the hell you think you're doing out here, but you better figure it out real freaking quick." And then he walked away. So the guys either thought they were scared or they chuckled or whatever. And all I know is, for whatever happened, Sean Reed Foley got out of the inning. So I think that was the right message at the right time in terms of that mound meeting.
Have you seen with John Schneider getting ejected earlier in the week? He's been ejected in 4.3% of his games as an MLB manager, and Gibby's career number is only 3.4%. So I don't know. There's some discrepancy there. Do you see a little bit of I guess the fiery John Gibbons in John Schneider?
It's a small sample size, but 4% is very impressive. Yeah. And Gibby would get tossed. But it's funny because Joe West would always, like, he called Gibby the pigeon. I said, why do you call him the pigeon? He goes, because all he does is over there, all he does is eat and poop. So but every time he would throw him out of a game, he'd come back. He goes, I just threw your boy out. And I thought it was hilarious. but Gibby's ejections are always pretty good. But Snides is there. Like, he's there for his team, and he likes it. I think it's, especially with the young manager, you got to be careful because you don't want umpires to start to turn on you. But I do like the fire. It's been a good thing, and I think he's been appropriate in all his ejections so far, too. Like, you know, Jeff Nelson, you know, we talked about the balk the other day and the bad strike zone call. He was the guy up in our game in game six in Kansas City when the strike zone mysteriously disappeared in the eighth. So, I think if anybody had it coming, it was him for sure.
I still feel bad for Ben Revere, by the way. Piggybacking off that, do we need an umpiring summit? Like, how does Angel Hernandez, among others, still have jobs? It just seems like every night I turn on baseball, whether it's the Jays, and I'm like, what the hell is going on? Like, there's got to be a conspiracy or something, right?
You know, I respect these guys because it's a really hard job. You guys are throwing the ball 97, 90 miles an hour. It's moving. And but also there's guys that are better at their job than others. And again, if you're not confrontational and you're not, you know, you're not always making a scene about yourself, then I think that's what everybody would want. Cause I think people do realize it's hard when those TV boxes show up and they're not exactly right all the time. Like, it's a hard job for them. Like, you can't get away from that. How you handle adversity, I think, is a big thing. You just want the guys to be like human beings and be consistent. Yeah. But I would say this, like, there's certain guys that are really good, consistently good behind the plate, and for them to only go back there every 5 days, you know, I would like to see a system more where the guys are rewarded more, or the better guys are the home. I love the human element. I'm seeing the automated strike zone in AAA right now, and it's not the fix. Unless it gets way better, this is not going to be an answer for anybody. But I would like to see the guys who are better at it, especially when it comes to postseason. The guys who earn their way back there should be back there more, and I just think that makes for a better game.
So what are some of the issues that you're seeing that make you say that it's not ready just yet?
It's not measured height, and they can't get it right low and high yet. Also, it might be a little bit wide. So, like, if it's 19 inches across, and then say you're a right-hander throwing a slider or a breaking ball to a right-handed hitter, the ball only has to nick the inside part of the plate. Like, the outer half of the ball has to hit the outer part of that box. And so it's a pitch. It's never a strike from start to finish and right up until the very end, and it's just that little smidget of the ball. So it's just hard. There's a lot of balls, and then you even see the umpires, especially in the low high. You see a good low strike or a definite ball low, and you see the umpires start to flinch one way or the other, and it's usually the opposite thing. So like it's presenting a bad visual right now, and the umpires that are going between calling their own game and then using this automated zone, like, you see them flinching, so you know there's a little bit of tinkering that still needs to be done with it.
Yeah, go ahead.
I just wanted to ask a quick follow-up on the umpiring, because Pat and Buck were talking, Pat and Dan were talking about it on the broadcast yesterday with Alec Manoah, and yeah, he pitches inside, but would you go and talk to an umpire before a game and kind of say that, lay out a little bit of a warning almost? My question would be, did you look at the umpires and maybe ever talk to your players about who was umpiring the game and things to be aware of, or was it just status quo, depending on whoever was behind the plate?
No, that was we actually had that. We had an umpire report all the time, so for hitters and for pitchers. And I'm sure it's much more detailed than when I was in Toronto. But you know where certain umpires like to call strikes, where their zones are. But you look at a heat map, and this guy likes to give pitches low and away. So when you realize that, you kind of go there and try to exploit it early. And if he's going to call there, you try to keep extending from that if that's part of your repertoire. And it's the same thing for the hitters. Like, there's certain umpires that, you know, call low strikes more than they call high strikes. There's certain ones that call high strikes more than low. So as a hitter, you have an idea of what they were going to call. And if you were indecisive about swings, like, you had that in your mind before you went up there. I don't know how many guys used it, but I'm sure for a lot of guys, they used it a little bit. And you kind of just use it as a blueprint, like, okay, this guy's staying true to what he normally calls, or he's going a little bit different today, and then I need to be more aggressive, either, you know, in pitches or in my swing decisions.
So I guess I call myself a baseball purist, and I'm just 33, and I'm with you. Like, I love the element of, you know, the human decision and all that. The home plate rule obviously has been a big topic of conversation in this country, in Toronto specifically, over the last little while. What do you think needs to be done? Because I'm still trying to figure out what Alejandro Kirk did wrong the other night.
Just be consistent with it. It's the biggest thing. And quite frankly, it shouldn't be that hard. If the catcher goes out in front of the plate and he sets up there and the throw is released, he can go wherever he wants. And I think that's the one thing that needs to be just reinstated and be enforced. So, you know, again, they got away from it. Like in most rules, they get a little bit lazy with it, and they didn't really worry about where the guy set up. And then all of a sudden someone in New York said, hey, we need to start cracking down on this, when it got away from him in the first place. And I think initially there wasn't all these problems with this. And then now this year they're starting to crack down. But again, I always say proactive is better than reactive. Like, if they would just keep reminding guys of, you know, what's required for you to do earlier and before it becomes a problem, and before you have all these embarrassing calls on like legit, like really easy outs, then I think that would go a long way. The umpires have the worst job in the world too, because when they put these rules into effect, Major League Baseball does a horrible job of explaining them to them. They leave a lot open to interpretation. So one crew might have a completely different interpretation than the other crew. And then so, like, if you go back-to-back series and two different crews have two different set of interpretations, like, that leads to problems for them. Like, the I spent my whole life hating umpires, and then when I walked away from 5 years, I realized, like, how tough it is for them, and they're put in the worst positions possible. But I think if everything comes down from New York and it's really well described and they make it very clear, then it's going to be a lot easier for the umpires. But I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon either.
Yeah, I'm with you. Like, I think you have to humanize the situation. It's a really, really tough job, you know, not to compare, but like, I umpired when I was, you know, a teenager, and I just remember the pressure of rep baseball, never mind Major League Baseball, when dollars and cents and all that are on the line. So yeah, like, that's a tough job for sure. But like, Angel Hernandez sucks at his job, among others. Anyways, thoughts on Gibby hitting social media? We've had him on the past couple of weeks, man. I can't believe you got to work with him. That's amazing.
It'd be great. And everyone asks, well, what's Gibby like? He's exactly how you perceive him to be. Like, he's really relaxed and he's really great. My wife and I were coming out of our apartment one time in the middle of a losing streak. So this was in 15. So it was like maybe May of 15. We're standing outside our apartment complex, and then the fans go by, hey, Gibby, why don't you try to win a few games? And Gibby goes, hey, that's a great idea. Maybe we'll do that. That's who he is. I mean, and that was the greatest thing. We also got on a train once. It was for the All-Star break, and we were all, like, going. We played Houston. Houston, like, beat the absolute living crap out of us, like, 16-1 or 16-2. And we literally got dressed immediately and went through the concourse, because you had to go to the train station to take the train to go to the airport. It was the only way you were going to get out of there. And here we are, like, 20 minutes after a game where we lost 16-2, sitting among every Blue Jay fan in the world, it was like Gibby just answering questions, and, you know, people were wearing him out. But at the same time, like, he completely won him over, because he was just a good guy. So, you know, the social media thing, it's a great way for people. I don't know how long he'll stay on it. I'm sure there's other reasons why he's on it for right now.
Mm-hmm.
But enjoy it while you can, because, you know, I got to spend 5 years with it, and it's relaxed. And every day in the clubhouse is exactly like probably like your 10-minute, 15-minute interview with him. Like, it was just, he is who he is, and there's no falseness about him. And it was an absolute pleasure to be around him.
I'm sure you'll be a guest on his upcoming podcast soon as well. I wanted to wrap with some hockey talk. I saw you at All-Star Weekend in Los Angeles a couple of years back. Tremendous time. Is this going to be the year that a Canadian team finally wins the Stanley Cup, Leafs?
I am going to play to the home country fanfare right now. Yeah, it absolutely is. It's going to be the Calgary Flames. No doubt about it. This is going to be their year. I've said that for years, but I think this is finally the year. How'd I do?
Really, really good. Really, really good. Who do you like this year, though?
Love it. Incredible. Thanks for the chat today, Tim. Really appreciate it. Let's hope that the Jays can go down to Texas and rack up a few more wins, get a real hold on this playoff spot, and keep up the good work through October. We really enjoyed the chat. We'll look forward to the next one.
All right. Really good talking to you guys, and we'll talk to you later for sure.
There you go. That's Tim Leeper, former first base coach with the Blue Jays, formerly on old John Gibbons' staff. Boy, how many tails do you think he has?
Yeah, how many beers do you think of? You know, beers too. I was thinking, but yeah, there's got to be some stories.
Yeah. Bud Lights, Budweisers. The guy loves it all. Loves it all. It's been a lot of fun to kind of go down memory lane with Leaper and with Gibbons and Ricky Romero, another guest we've had on a few times lately. So I've enjoyed some of these other chats with some of our Blue Jays guys, the former Blue Jays guys who are also enjoying this iteration of the team.
I've had some weird run-ins with former Jays. I don't know if you remember reliever Jason Fraser. He was a reliever a couple years back. He was a Gibby favorite, but I ran into him at a wedding. He actually married like my buddy's wife's sister, something like that. He was at the wedding. We talk shop. We talk baseball. Like, I love bumping into these dudes. Even, you know, going out this summer or in the last year, I've bumped into Pete Walker. I bumped into John Schneider, another former Jay, Josh Towers. I came across doing some hits for Veasan in Vegas. So he's doing some betting stuff out there. But just to talk about, you know, old players and guys I grew up watching, you know, even reminiscing the other day about like a Carlos Delgado. I still remember vividly his 4-home-run game against Tampa, because it came to mind at the dinner table with my family because of Bo Bichette's 3-home-run game. And I was like, man, I remember when Carlos Delgado hit 4 bombs in a game. It's like you would think a team would stop pitching to him, you know, by the third at bat. But it just, again, there's been so many great players that have rolled through this country, and it's so great to see the Jays extremely relevant and potentially winning a World Series sometime soon here.
That would be pretty cool. I will say that would be pretty cool. I certainly enjoyed watching the Raptors win a title. Mm-hmm. Even
dude, I went to the parade. From here. My goodness. Yeah. Like I know I didn't go to the parade, but I went to the, when they won the championship, I was downtown Toronto at a friend's condo. So we partied like rock stars, man. I'm telling you, and you guys got a bit of a sniff of it, and Calgary didn't end up winning it, but the Red Mile I thought was tremendous. There is nothing like that celebration, because you could literally do whatever you do and nobody's going to do anything to you. Like, it's in terms of like partying, like they opened up a street and there was, you know, cops there for crowd control, but you can literally do what you want to do and just celebrate, because again, there's no other feeling. And as a lifelong Raptors fan, like that was like the pinnacle of my sports watching and loving career, man. I want to feel that again with the Jays, you know?
Well, and I think that, you know, when you look at the big four sports in Canada, the NBA would probably be number 4 behind hockey. Mm-hmm. I would say probably next would be baseball, and then a combination to CFL and NFL, but just football in general. So if the Jays were able to do it, like, that's, you get a significant more amount of fans compared to the Raptors. It would be pretty wild to see the whole country up in celebration. Just a few texts coming in at 960-960. This one says he does a solid Gibby as well. Like Tim Leepers.
I was going to say
it was pretty good. It was spot on, but you spend enough time around the guy, you start to emulate him. Most of my knowledge of the Blue Jays roster is from MVP Baseball 2005. Jason Fraser was on that team. I traded
incredible
him away.
Game. Pujols was on that cover. Incredible game.
I made
incredible game.
This one's going to need a follow-up. It says, I made a complete ass out of myself in front of Ricky Romero if you want a good story. We do. Ooh, we'll read it during what you want to talk about at 8:30. How about that?
And Pujols was on the 04 cover, my mistake. 05 was Manny Ramirez, but still exceptional game at MVP Baseball.
And then this one just says, with 2 exclamation marks, keep Nick Alberga on the show. Oh, want it.
No comment.
Tim Leeper joined us down the Atlas Pizza and Sports Bar guest hotline, 14-time Consumer Choice Award winner for takeout or delivery, 403-248-3344, or dine in at Atlas Pizza, 6060 Memorial Drive Northeast. Hey, it's the start of the NFL season tonight. It's the Bills and it's the Rams. We're going to get some of your best bets. Cabby is going to join us coming up from Sportsnet Bets. We'll ask him about Week 1, this matchup, and some futures. And we're also going to talk to Steve Tasker, who covers the Bills out in Buffalo. He used to play for the Bills as well. We'll get into all of that around the corner as we continue to give the Atlas Pizza and Sports Bar guest hotline quite the workout. Sportsnet 960, The Fan.